The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we're now in the month of Vesak, or Visakha Puja. And Vesak it normally falls on the full moon of May. But this year, I'm not sure, I think it's because it's a leap year, but it's the Sri Lankan Sangha celebrating Vesak on the, well, already have celebrated Vesak on the full moon of May, on the 6th of May. And the Thai Sangha are celebrating Vesak on the 4th of June. So there's some discrepancy about when the Vesak moon falls this year. So since we're neither Sri Lankan nor Thai, I'm not sure what the Burmese, which moon the Burmese are following, but I figure since we're, you know, not from a Buddhist country, we can celebrate Vesak through the whole month, from one moon to the next. So I started our Vesak celebration on the full moon of May by going to Aranya Bodhi Hermitage in Jena, where our preceptor lives, and we took part in the first, in a very early morning, like just as dawn was breaking, we took part in an ordination of two women, full ordination of two women, two novices, Samaneri Marajina and Samaneri Nibida. So they had the first half of their ordination in Jena, and then we all got into cars and we drove off to Sacramento, and we had the second part of the ordination in Sacramento with the Bhikkhu Sangha. And three of those monks had driven up that morning at about 4:30 in the morning from LA to be there to support the ordination. So it was very lovely, and we had a big meal and then a Vesak celebration, and then the second part of the ordination in the afternoon. So Vesak is traditionally it's the Buddha was said to have been born on the full moon, on the Vesak full moon. So in the calendar that was used at the Buddha's time, they used a lunar calendar, and each moon had a particular name. So it more or less corresponds with what's the May moon in our calendar. So on the Vesak, the full moon of Vesak, the Buddha was born under a sal tree as his mother was making her way back to her family, which was the tradition in those days to give birth at your parents' home. So he was born under a sal tree on the full moon of Vesak, and he was enlightened under what was actually called the peepal tree, which we now call the Bodhi tree, on the full moon of Vesak. And he died. He breathed his last under a grove of sal trees on the full moon of Vesak. So Vesak is the day to recollect and remember the Buddha. And you know, we can very easily feel a little bit disconnected from the Buddha as a person, particularly if we've not actually been to the pilgrimage places. And you know, often in the West we come across Buddhism as a more of a, often a technique-oriented practice, or a can be a very rational, pragmatic teaching and practice, because it is, and we can miss the spirit of the beauty of the fact that there was this human being alive in 2,500 or so years ago in India, who became through his own efforts fully enlightened, and who, you know, walked around and taught the Dhamma for the welfare of the many folk, as they say, for the long-lasting benefit of the many folk, of which we are part. It's still filtering down to us. It's quite remarkable that And this is a human being. This is a man who was born from his mother's womb, just as we were, and who, you know, ate and cried and went to the toilet and experienced physical pain, experienced gain and loss, you know, love and loss. And through his efforts, you know, realized full enlightenment. And he taught for 40 years. He walked around India and Nepal teaching for 40 years until he was in his 80s. And then when it was the right time, he lay down and breathed his last. So we don't usually say that the Buddha died, even though that the body died, because we speak about the Buddha's parinibbana. So it's like the complete ending. So it wasn't like, it was like all, there was no more work to be done, everything was laid down. At the end of his life there was no more attachment, no more things to do, no more wishes. It was just the completion, the full completion of a life. So I like to think, you know, it's lovely to think of the, you know, of the Buddha as a human being. I think it's very important actually to just bring that to mind, that just like us, human being, you know, the Buddha was also just a human being. So enlightenment and realization is attainable to all of us if we keep putting our mind in the right place and keep bringing attention to our practice and guiding our life in the right direction. And, you know, maybe this life, maybe future life, who knows. But it doesn't really matter. What really matters is bringing attention to this, to what is going on now in this moment, in any given moment. And, you know, so we've all been born and we're all going to die at some point when it's the right time. And in between those two points, there's what we can do with our life. You know, so there's such a huge array of possibilities that one can use that time for. And so I like to, you know, particularly around this Wesak time, to really refresh the possibility that we can use this life for awakening, for fully awakening. And, you know, most of us have those thoughts that say, well, you know, I can't do it because dot, dot, dot. You know. And, you know, we probably won't be able to become a fully enlightened Buddha. That's most likely we won't, unless anyone's very, very highly attained already here. But, you know, as when we're chanting at the beginning of the evening, we chant the qualities of the Sangha. You know, that Sangha, it's not the monastic Sangha. It's not saying, you know, the monastic Sangha is worthy of gifts, worthy of offerings. It's saying the Sangha of those who have gained insight into the path. So that's monks and nuns and lay women and lay men who have gained insight into the path. This is the Sangha who have practiced well, who have practiced directly, who have practiced with integrity, who give occasion for incomparable goodness to arise in the world. And, you know, we so easily put it up on a pedestal and feel that we can't do that, you know, because of our conditioning or our background or our mind states, whatever it might be that we think are an obstacle to our practice. But if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha is pointing us back to our experience as it is in any given moment. So, you know, one can approach this teaching as in a very complex and detailed way, or one can approach it in a simple and immediate way, which is my preference. So, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha is encouraging us to know the body as the body. So in that first part of the meditation, I was guiding you to bring awareness to the body as it is. I don't know about you, but when I first started to practice that, almost inevitably I would go to sleep. It was almost impossible for me to keep attention on my body. It was just, no, don't want to be there. And then gradually over the years, you know, recognizing here it is, you know, body and mind, we're kind of in this for the lifetime together, so, you know, might as well get to know each other a bit better. You know, then over the years I've found that the body has become a very wonderful refuge and foundation, because it's always here. It's always here, and the mind can spin off, get involved in all kinds of things, and get the emotions can get really agitated and excited, and then the mind gets lost in them, spinning off. But the body is just here. It's right here, and you know, you can feel all of the emotions in the body, but you know, the body is holding that. So I found that this good friend here is very helpful on the path, and I can bring my attention back to this body, whatever's going on, in the midst of turmoil, in a very challenging situation where somebody's having a go at me and I'm feeling really agitated and I want to retaliate, but I know that that isn't going to help. And then I just say, okay, body, what's going on in the body now? Feeling agitated, feeling anxious. And then there's the breath. So there's the breath, and I can breathe with that feeling. And then that gives it a little space. I'm not so caught in the reactivity. And then I know, then I see, well, what is this feeling? It's unpleasant feeling. This is a really unpleasant feeling and I don't like it. And I'd like to be able to do something that I can get away from this feeling. But that trying to get away from is a step off the path. So the path is coming back to the feeling. Okay, unpleasant feeling. Feels like this. It's kind of hard to bear, but it's just like this, and it's fluctuating, it's changing. It's not going to be like this forever. And then the breath gives it a little bit more ease. And then there's the, you know, ability to bear with it. So instead of just throwing something back, creating a whole scenario, a big, maybe even a lifetime's problem, I can stay with that feeling for, it might just be just a few minutes, or it might be an hour or two, depending on how strong it is. And eventually that feeling subsides, and there's been an opportunity to, you know, that has been, the path has been right there. I've stepped onto the path by turning my attention to that feeling. If I'd have retaliated, I'd have stepped off the path. I'd have stepped right into the cycle of samsara and added to it. But by turning back here and being with the feeling, which is the second foundation of mindfulness, knowing it as it is, unpleasant feeling, knowing its nature, using right understanding, it is changing. It's not who and what I am. So it's not to say, dissociate from it, saying, this is not me, this is not mine. But to be with it and to know this is a process that's going on. It's got a cause. It's arising in this way, and it will cease if I put my attention to it in the right way. And then, you know, bringing attention to the mind states, which is the third foundation of mindfulness. So I find it very interesting with the body. You know, what attitude do we bring to this body? And people are so often indifferent to the body, or even a bit condescending and a bit averse and looking down on it. It's this thing we kind of tolerate. And then the mind can be really exalted, wonderful, but the body, you know. So, or we may have had physical trauma, you know, and then the body's a fearful place to be. We don't want to be there. So we find all these ways of escaping. And meditation can be that. We can use meditation as a means of escape from the body for some time. But the Buddha is inviting us to come back, you know, to know the body as the body. and to know the feelings as the feelings, and to know the mind state as the mind state, to know it as it is. So it's an interesting investigation to bring attention to your mind state at any given moment. You know, when you sit down to meditate, to just check what mindset am I meeting this with? Am I meeting this meditation with grasping? Do I want to get something out of it? Or am I meeting it with a version I want to check out because I don't really want to be here? I don't want to have to deal with the conditioned world. I don't want to have to deal with this body, these feelings, the aging process, the challenges of life. So I just want to just check out in my meditation and not have to deal with any of it, you know. So, you know, it could be nice, have a little holiday, but it's not liberating. It's stepping off the path. So, you know, to bring attention to the way we meet our experience. You know, when we do this, we're stepping back on the path to awakening. It's right here. And it's not saying, you know, we have to wait for a nice, wholesome, beautiful mind state before we do that. It's knowing this mind state, whatever it might be, however it is, as it is. Knowing it as it is. And again, bringing right understanding. So we're not being with the mind state saying, this is me, you know, I am, oh, there's me again doing this, you know, there I am again, thinking in this way. It's not grasping hold of it as me and mine, but it's knowing the mind state, knowing that it's not fully what I am, although it conditions the way we manifest in the world, but it's not whom what I am. It's a mind state, it's a filter, it's a colouring on our experience. It's obscuring us from seeing clearly. But once we bring our attention back to that mind state, however deluded it may be, if we can pay attention to it, if we can know it for what it is, then there's clarity. So there can be clarity with desire, there can be clarity with fear, clarity with anger, clarity with confusion. Interestingly enough, I've experimented with this quite a bit. Clarity, there can be perfect clarity with confusion. You know perfectly that this is confused mind state, and you know that how it is, how it affects the mind, and you're limited by it and all of that, and there's great clarity. And you know that this is not whom I am, it's a passing cloud. And, you know, the true nature of the mind is bright and clear and open. So it's learning to, you know, be the awareness that knows the experience. And then there are the objects of mind. So, you know, there's the five hindrances of sensual desire and ill will or aversion. Restlessness and sloth or sleepiness, dullness and doubt. So those five hindrances. It's very, very helpful to know them, you know, and just to notice, you know, which is present right now. So when we know sensual desire is present, you know, we might not be able to completely stop following it, but we know it for what it is. It's sensual desire. We've followed it a million times before. It hasn't led to ultimate satisfaction yet. Likelihood is it won't, you know. So we know what it is, and then if we can't stop ourselves following it, at least we know, okay, here I go again, you know. And hopefully not towards something that's too harmful. If we're following something that's really harmful, then we should just stop it. Just go and do something else. But if it's something harmless enough, you know, relatively harmless, like eating a cream cake or whatever it might be, then just to know it's, you know, just to know the whole process of that, of following sensual desire. It has its promise, it has its moments of gratification, it ends, we look for the next thing. And that's how it works. So, you know, we can have that moment of gratification and it gives a little temporary relief, but, you know, it's just still, again, it's caught on that wheel, it's on that hamster wheel of constantly searching for that pleasure that's going to give us satisfaction. And, you know, ill will. Ill will is quite a strong term, but I find that ill will, it manifests in many ways, in very subtle ways sometimes. So there's the obvious, like, outward anger, even maybe violent feelings. And there's a strong aversion. Fear is also a type of ill will. And depression is kind of rooted in ill will, wanting to push something away, not wanting to let things in. You know, these all have kind of ill will as their basis. Or, you know, just sort of having a grudge against something or a resistance. So there was a point when I realized, not long after I came to live in America, I realized I don't drive, but in terms of my life, I'm driving with the brakes on. You know, here I'm in this life, there's all these things going on, and I got the brake on all the time. There's this kind of resistance, fear, resistance, not sure. And then, it's exhausting living like that. And at some point, it's like, well, what would happen if I just took my foot off the brake? You know, just let life do what it's doing and meet it as best I can. And it's like, oh, what a relief. Such a relief. And maybe for a while it feels a bit fast and, you know, I don't feel I can quite keep up with it. And then after a while I kind of get used to it. It's no problem. And then increasingly just being able to open to this, you know, to life as it appears, as it comes. So these are all kind of aspects of ill will, that kind of resistance and the, you know, from that to, and depression, fear, anger, resentment, these are all aspects of ill will. So just to get to know them. So it's not to judge them and say, oh, I shouldn't have that, that's a hindrance, not supposed to have ill will, but to know it, you know, to turn your attention to that experience. So the, you know, this is all within the framework of the foundations of mindfulness. So putting one's attention on that is stepping back on the path. And it can seem kind of counterintuitive. To be with strong resentment is the path. You know, you feel like, no, it should be getting rid of resentment. It should be free from resentment. But it's just trusting that process, that of continuously bringing your attention to what is happening here and now, that in itself will lead you in the right direction. You know, we can't always root out. You know, we might know what we don't want to have, and the intellect, it's clear, it knows where it's going, knows what it wants to do, it knows what it wants to get rid of. And then there's the body and the karma, the process, you know, the condition that's here, and that has its own pace. It can't always keep up with the mind and the intention. So to have the compassion, really, and humility to slow down enough to be with what's happening now, rather than some idea of what we think it should be, or how we should be, or what should be happening now. So, you know, I won't go into great detail with the other hindrances of restlessness and dullness and doubt, but with all of these, it's again to bring your attention to them. So bring your attention to the quality of restlessness. It's an unpleasant feeling. It's agitated, it's unsettled, you know, it's wanting to be somewhere else. So bringing your attention as much as you can to that experience of restlessness. And you can use the breath again. Take some really deep, calming breaths to help soothe that restlessness. And sleepiness or dullness, it's a tricky thing to deal with, But again, it's kind of an unpleasant, well, it can be pleasant, it can be unpleasant or pleasant experience. But it's, you know, for those of us who are interested in the path of awakening, you know, it's an obvious hindrance. It's obviously going in the wrong direction. So, you know, not to be lulled by that that kind of nice, soft, oh, having a really peaceful meditation. You know, and you wake up at the end and the bell rings. Oh, that's nice. I had a good meditation. I feel much better, you know. Don't be lulled by that. You know, try to know it when it happens. I suffer from this one. So, you know, try to know that when it's going on and you know, change your posture, maybe stand up, take some deep breaths. There's various things. If your light's on, you can open your eyes and let the light. So these are all ways you can that can help with dullness, drowsiness. And then there's doubt, which keeps, it's like a dog chasing its tail. It thinks it's getting somewhere and it can go faster and faster, but it's just never going anywhere. It's going crazy. So, you know, with doubt, you just have to stop following the doubt and just come back to the body. Or come back to the breath, whichever is most accessible. And then the doubts carry on, and then you just say, I'm not paying attention to you right now. I'm going to be with the breath, okay? Breath. So it's not that it necessarily goes away, but we don't feed it with our attention. So these are some of the dhammas, or the minds, the objects of mind that we can be aware of. And we can also be aware of the wholesome objects of mind. You know, I have a bit of a block with the seven factors of enlightenment. I can never quite remember them all. But qualities of investigation of dhammas, mindfulness. I won't go through them because I don't know why these are, over all these years, I've never been able to keep them in my mind. But knowing when the wholesome qualities are present also, the concentration, focus, collectedness of mind. So it's, what I'm trying to point to is that whatever is going on in our experience at any given moment, this is the path. Paying attention to this, whatever it may be, is the path to awakening. And it's not like waiting for something else or till we're better. It's not that. It's this. It's this. Even this delusion that we have is paying attention with clarity to this. This is what brings us back onto the path. Or, you know, being with our own generosity and feeling the joy of generosity. This is what brings us back to the path. Noticing a judgment that comes in. Oh, you shouldn't get into your own generosity. That's selfish. Then you notice that judgment. Not adding to it with another judgment, but just knowing it for what it is. Oh, that's a judgment. That's in the ill will category. So, and then just knowing that, and then feeling what that feels like, and that just that knowing is bringing us back to the path. So, you know, really, we have no excuses, actually. Because here's this body and here's this mind. Here are these mind objects. Here are the feelings. It's all here. And it's just for us to remember that this is our opportunity. Right, this, right as it is our opportunity. You know, we've been given this human birth, which, you know, doesn't always feel so precious. I didn't originally experience it as a wonderful thing, I have to say. But over the years, with the practice, I've come to, you know, greatly appreciate this human experience. It's challenging. It's painful. It's gratifying. It can be blissful. It's got an amazing range of experience, from the most awful to the most wonderful. And I've experienced a pretty good range of all of that, and in between. And in that is the door, the opening to freedom. So in our suffering is the door. If we turn around and face it, that is the door to freedom. In our joy, if we turn around and face it, that is the door to our freedom. And it's through being with it as it is, not through holding on to it and identifying with it and making it me and mine, but through just meeting it in the moment. That is the place of awakening. And over time, as we continue this practice, there's just a natural incentive towards the wholesome and away from the unwholesome. It's a natural process. It's when we stay semi-conscious that isn't a natural process, because we can fudge things, we can cover things up, we can make excuses, we can eat something, drink something, switch on something that we don't have to feel the effects of our thoughts and actions and speech. But when we're actually using this experience as a door to enlightenment or to awakening, we feel the repercussions of our foolishness and our unskillfulness, and we don't want to keep following it. We don't want to keep feeding it. It's a huge incentive to find a way out, to find the place of freedom. And it might not just be our foolishness. It might just be, it could be old trauma patterns, reactive patterns. But then get to know them. They're conditioned. They're not our true nature. Get to know them. Learn to be with them. Give them proper attention. And through that, they start to change. We find more freedom in our lives. So it's a very simple practice, and very easily overlooked. And it's like the door is right here when we turn our attention back. The door to the deathless is right here. So I'd like to end there, and I'd like to open up for any questions, because there might be gaps in what I've said, places that don't make sense to you. So my intention is to offer the signpost, really, that you can find the way out of suffering. So please feel free to ask any questions in regard to what I've said and in regard to your own practice. Or to share, if you have anything you'd like to share. And if it doesn't make any sense to you at all, then please say so. Yes.
Sister, would you say a little more about when the body is so uncomfortable, there's pain in the body, perhaps trauma?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are different things. There's physical pain because of, maybe the different reasons. It could be because of just the natural aging of the body. It does get more painful. It could be an injury, or there could be an illness that's giving chronic pain. So, there are different kinds of physical pain, and there's also like a kind of a phantom pain that one can experience in the meditation. That there's more like a tension pain. So the mind starts to tense up, and then the body starts to tense up because you're thinking, I'm going to sit here for 45 minutes. And then you start to feel all these pains that you don't normally feel. But if you're sitting in front of your computer, you wouldn't even notice your body at all. You know? But because you're sitting being attentive, you feel all these pains. So that's if when you get up, those pains are gone, then or within a minute or two, or a second, or a few seconds, then don't worry about them. They're just what the mind is throwing up and the body is throwing up as a distraction. So then you could learn to investigate those pains and be with them as they are. And in the beginning of the meditation, I was doing that guided body sweeping. So what tends to happen is when we feel a pain in the body, if it's a physical pain, our mind latches hold of that, and we don't know anything else that's going on apart from that pain. And then we start to make all kinds of stories about what's going to happen, how terrible it all is. And so to learn to sweep the attention through the body. So if you can't get it off that knee that's painful, then just see if you can, if you can't sweep through the body, then just move your attention to the other knee, unless that's also painful, or to your right elbow. And then so it's like, okay, that's really painful. What's happening at the right elbow? Nothing much. You know, so why can't the mind also, can the mind also be with that nothing much? It's just as valid. So like training the mind to be with the body in any place, with the pleasure, pain, neither pain nor pleasure, training the mind to be with all of it. If you have a physical injury or a chronic, you know, then you have to be careful not to strain it. If you have chronic pain, I've never really had chronic pain, but if you have chronic pain, then, you know, it's really necessary to learn ways to be with that. So to know it as a sensation, to be able to put one's attention to, say, for example, the breath, that can give some ease, so you're not just latched onto the body. And I mean, you'd be better off asking someone who has really practiced with chronic pain, but, you know, to have a sense of let the mind encompass the body. So you're not fighting it. The mind isn't fighting the body, trying to get away from it because it can't. But it can in some states of meditation. But to learn to embrace that whole experience, and to know this is painful feeling, it's unpleasant feeling, and to, you know, allow that to be in consciousness. If you practice the absorptions, which I am not a jhana practitioner myself, but if you practice the jhanas, the absorptions, then you can also experience, even with chronic pain, you can experience mind states that are completely free from pain, because the mind is no longer aware of or identified with the body for periods of time. But then when you come out of that, you're just back with the same situation again. So it's like a temporary relief. But the really, I would say, more useful, or on a long, you know, more liberating practice, is to be with that feeling and know it as painful feeling, and see how it is actually constantly changing. Even with chronic pain, it's constantly fluctuating. So to be with the flux of it, yeah. And then if there's like trauma, like there's emotional trauma in the body. So there might be something might happen, and then you have very, very strong feeling arising in the body, like in the belly or in the heart. Then that's also, it's in a similar way, you know, to turn to that and be with that, and to breathe through that, and to know, to see the strength of reaction, and to, you know, not add to it, not react or start living it out, but to, and not suppress it, but to allow the mind to embrace that and know it and feel it and watch it as it's going through its process, and see it come to its end, whenever that will be, and then know how it is after. So it's taking it through the whole process, because we tend to just take segments of experience, you know. We don't notice something arising, we don't notice it ceasing, but we notice it when it's in its peak, and then it's like, you know, or wow, fantastic, you know, whatever it is. But we don't notice the process. So when we bring attention to each moment as best as we can, we see the process. We see the beginning, the increase, the kind of climax, and then the decrease, and then the end, and then maybe the space after. And then the next thing arises. So you get to see that process. And then it kind of doesn't, it's not, it doesn't grip us in the same way. Yes, Bill.
I think one of the reasons I've never been drawn toward body scans is that I have a hard time noticing particular parts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if someone asks me to notice a particular spot on the back of my hand, if nothing is touching that part of my hand, there's really no sensation there.
So if I say now, be aware of your left shoulder, can you feel anything?
So faintly, I'm not sure that I really do notice anything. Maybe I'm imagining, but even so, it's very, very faint.
Very soft.
And maybe with practice, you can develop
a
bit more sensitivity.
Yes, you do, yeah. So, so can I just ask, if I say be aware of the whole body sitting, can you be aware of that?
Well, it's hard to say what I'm noticing. There's
Close your eyes a moment. How do you know that there's a body? Do you know?
The place I really notice is where my rear
It's pressure.
Yes, because there's pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Clothing is covering so much of my body, there's really hard to... There's no distinct feeling for any one place.
Is there any sense of warmth or coolness?
Yes, there's warmth.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes, for my limbs, I imagine the blood coursing through my limbs, and then a sense of heat or energy seems noticeable. So, so with my limbs, it's different.
If
I do that little
trick. The limbs, that's good. And then, so there's four of those. That's quite a lot already. And then, and then, what about the breath? Can you notice when you're breathing? Can you notice that the body moves with the breath? I mean, just naturally.
Yes.
So that's where do you feel that? I mean, is it just up
in
here?
In my throat.
Throat.
Where the air moves, and not so easily, but you know, the whole torso less so, but yes.
So now we've got, that's doing pretty good. They've got four limbs and a torso now. Okay, that's great. And what about your face?
When you did that part of the instruction, for some reason I felt like I could notice my face. But not the entire head.
Not the entire head. Yeah, the head is difficult. It is difficult because there's so much thinking, and often, and then it's got this sort of. It can be a bit formless. Yeah. Well, so that's pretty good, isn't it? So most of it's there.
Clasping my hands, and you or if I ask myself to notice the left hand, what I notice is where the hands are touching, and so what I notice really is. Both hands. It's very hard to distinguish one from the other.
All right. So that's okay. You can just know that.
I get the sense that the instruction would be just to practice. And
the thing, I mean, well, you've already shown that you actually, there is much more awareness than you originally thought. So that's, you know, so that's one thing. And then when we don't pay attention, just like anything we ignore, you know, if you have a plant, and then we ignore it. It shrivels off and dies. It doesn't survive. It doesn't flourish. You know, if we ignore children, they go off. Well, they do all kinds of things. But you know, they're not. They don't. They go away. They don't. Eventually, they don't bother anymore. They give up. You know, and it's the same with our body. So if we ignore it, we can't, it's like it's kind of given up on the mind, you know. Whereas actually the mind, body and mind are, you know, they're meant to be in relationship. And if we don't pay attention to the body, because what we tend to do is put a lot of attention on the thoughts, but not very much attention on the physical body. And, you know, when we do that, then we're ignoring the body. And so we try and put our attention on the right elbow, and they can't feel anything at all because it's not used to having any attention. And we're used to, you know, our attention being grasped by something. It's got to be interesting. So it's like you can feel the buttocks because it's kind of, okay, it's maybe a little bit starting to get a bit squashed. And so it's something going on there. But because there's nothing very interesting happening on the right elbow, you can't feel it. But what I've discovered, because I basically had a lot of difficulty having awareness of the body when I was the first several years actually that I was practicing. And then I decided to pick it up as a practice because I needed to. And now what I find is it's very easy. It's like I just have to remind myself to be aware of the body, and then here it is, right here, feeling, you know. But you have to keep bringing attention and knowing those three kinds of feelings. So there's pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither pleasant nor painful feeling. So what I would suggest is when you go to those places where you don't feel anything, you say, neither pleasant nor painful feeling, and just call it that. And then go to the next part, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, and then maybe pleasant feeling. And it might be that much of your body is that neither painful nor pleasant. And then as you keep doing that, it's like it's an acknowledgement of the body. And then it gradually starts to come into presence more. And then increasingly there is either pleasant or unpleasant feeling, and then there'll be some that's neutral. But increasingly it will fall into one of those categories, and you'll feel more alive, actually, and more connected. Yeah.
And then I guess when you get to where you can notice any part of your body,
yes,
or almost any part,
yes, any.
As soon as you put your attention to it, since your body is, in a way, you, that must be a great thing, in a way.
Well, you know,
does it feel that way?
It feels, well, it's like the body and the mind are integrated. It's not that the body is you, but it's that the body and the mind are integrated, and they affect each other, you know, the path is about being with this body and mind. That's basically what it is. It's coming back to this. It's using this body and mind as a teacher. So here it is, you know, we've got this amazing teacher, and then we kind of check out. So it's more like, it's not always pleasant. Sometimes it can be quite intense and quite difficult, painful, and sometimes it can be wonderful and peaceful and pleasurable. It has all of those. But it's more that the important thing is that there is presence. That's what's important. So over, you know, as you practice, what's the things that are arising in consciousness don't matter so much. It's the fact of being conscious that's important. It's the fact that there is awareness that really, really matters. Not that the awareness is with something pleasant or painful or neither. So, and that develops over time with practice. Yeah. And that's the place of real freedom. Because then the awareness itself is not, it's not really making any deals with life anymore. It's with this. And there's great freedom in that. Yeah.
This is very helpful.
Good.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, one more question. Yes. Oh, it's being recorded.
Okay, so it makes a lot of sense what you're saying about staying with your feeling and allowing your feeling to present itself and then become more clear of where it comes from, and your mindset is more clear. But what if your mindset is you have a distorted mindset about your body?
Well, I think most of us do. That's why I spoke about it, actually. I think most of us do have a distorted mindset. We either perceive it, you know, as being different to how it is. Like some people feel that they're very thin when they're not very thin, or they feel that they're enormously fat when they're not. You know, you have those things. I mean, when it's actually an eating disorder, then it's really difficult because it's a very distorted perception. But you know, I know a woman who, she was actually on the verge of death through anorexia. Oh, really? Okay. So she'd been twice anorexic, once when she was in her teens, and then again in her I think early 30s or something like that. And she was really very, very seriously ill. So there's different categories, and she was at the point of near imminent death. That's the category she was in. And somehow she decided to live. So she could have just gone with that and died, you know. But she decided she wanted to live and she wanted to get on with her life, and she had a practice. And she did actually end up in hospital. I mean, she needed to be in hospital. And for some time there was no way that she could just be with the body. All she could do was to follow the program, eat and, you know, do the things that she had to do and start to clear out some of the causes, you know, some of the stuff that had caused her to go into that pattern in the first place. And then over time, she kept, you know, she had this kind of very clear mindset that she wanted to get out of that pattern. She knew it, and she wanted to get out of it, and she knew it was crazy. The she said it's like a mental illness, you know. Yeah, right. And she kind of knew that, and even though she had it, she knew it, and so she just kept working with awareness, actually, and eating and doing all the things that she was told to do to help get out of it. And at times it was very, very difficult, very, very, very challenging. And, you know, she'd feel, you know, all kinds of very strong emotions would come up, because the eating, the not eating, is what protects an anorexic person from feeling, basically. So all of those feelings would come up, and it'd be really, really difficult. And yet she knew that they are feelings and they are changing, and however difficult they may be, if I just stay with it, it'll be okay. So she had that refuge. And then over time she, you know, basically got completely cured herself, actually, of anorexia. And now she's amazing. She eats in a very healthy way, in terms of, I don't mean only eats healthy, but in terms of she can enjoy eating. She'll eat with people socially, she can enjoy eating, she eats enough, she's strong, she looks really kind of muscular and healthy. You know, you'd never imagine that this is the same person who almost died of anorexia. And it took that strong intention to live, because you have to really want to get out of it, because it's difficult. And the understanding that it's a feeling and a thought that's happening. And a feeling and a thought can't actually harm me. That's also a very important part of it. Because what we tend to do is we take the feelings to be real and personal, and then we can't bear them, and so we do something to get away. And we take the thoughts to be real and personal, we don't want to be with them, so we do something to get away from them. So it's having that courage, really, to be willing to face those things, those feelings and thoughts, and allow them to change, knowing that they change. Yeah. And I think having a you know, supportive environment, loving people and people who encourage, is really, really important too. Yeah. Wherever they may be. Yeah. But it can be done. Yeah. So we're a little bit over time, and I'd like to just let people know, I don't have flyers, but so there are a few things at the Vihara, or connected with the Vihara. So if you've got a pen and paper, you can write it down. So on the 27th of May, we're going to have a day-long. I think that's a Sunday. We have a day-long at Aloka Vihara. And all of this information you can look on our website. So there are cards over there, and it'll give you all the information. But there's a day-long. It's a Wesak day-long, because it's the Wesak month. So everyone's welcome. There's no registration. You can just come and bring a dish to share. So we have a shared meal. And on June 5th till the 10th, Ayasanth Chitta and I will be teaching a retreat at Spirit Rock. It's a Dana retreat, and there are still spaces if anyone wants to attend that retreat. So it's from the 5th until the 10th. It's 5th until the 10th of June. June 5th till 10th. And also, just so it's a long way in the future, but also to let you know that every year we have a New Year retreat. It varies in length, and this coming year it's going to be a week long. Last year it was 2 weeks. And we'll be holding it at the Insight Meditation Retreat Centre. Yay. We got this long letter from Gil saying we don't have a cook, we don't have a managers, and we're like, well, that's perfect for us.
We can...
Huh?
We don't have beds.
Oh, we didn't mention the beds. Okay. And that will be from the 26th of December until the 1st of January. And that's also a Dana retreat. So everyone's welcome. There's not actually registration yet, but if you want to save the date, that's happening. Okay. So let's end with a little...